slucas.me presents. Whether you meant to or not, you found Noobs Book Club. Hello and welcome. I'm Sean from slucas.me, and in this particular series, I am reading and reacting to The Girl with the Dragon Tattoo, the novel by Stieg Larsson. This is part three of this series, part three of six, I think it is. Oh no, actually part three of eight, which I'm filling in because I was going to do the new Dragonlance novel, War Wizard, this month, but I was not able to pick it up on the Cape like I expected, so I just ordered it yesterday, and it should be here in 4 to 10 days, they said. Hopefully I can fit it in August. If not, it might spill over into September, and I'll finish up that one and this one in September for Frighttober and Dracula. Quick recap from part two. Blomqvist leaves his job at the magazine Millennium. Both he and Berger are dismayed about it, but they also understand that he needs to take care of business, and as he's doing that, it might reflect poorly on the magazine, which is not doing well anyway to begin with. We also learned that Salander has an annoying feeling about Venestrom. Venestrom is the reason that Blomqvist is in trouble. Blomqvist libeled him in an article that he wrote, and libel laws in Sweden are obviously much stronger than they are here in America, so Venestrom was able to sue him, take him to court, and Blomqvist faced a fine and jail time for his libel. Salander, she has a quote-unquote gnawing feeling about Venestrom, so that's one of the ways that the two characters will find themselves meeting and working together. This time around, we're going to get Blomqvist on the island. He went to the island to take the job that Vanger offered him, which was to look into Harriet's disappearance. The cover story is that he is going to write a family history of the Vanger family. Salander, on her end, her nightmare is beginning. We'll get more into that later. But if you know the book and you understand the major theme of the book, then you know what's coming, and it is not going to be pretty for Salander and ultimately the people who wrong her. In this episode, I'm going to cover chapters 8 through 11. I will do what I normally do. I listened to the book. I went through the supersummary.com. I came up with some questions and themes to discuss. So that's what the majority of the episode will be. Me talking about some quick summary with a little bit of analysis, and then I will cover the major themes, and then we'll be done. Okay, I think it's enough for intro. Let's get into the book. Last time around, I think I mentioned that the setting, the island, was a character unto itself. That comes through here because Blomqvist is on the island. He chooses to live alone instead of living in Vanger's house. He lives in a farmhouse alone. When we're going through a tough time, we think that we want to be left alone. Blomqvist gets that, and he realizes it's not what he wants at all. He quickly reaches out to people. He goes to a cafe to work so that he can talk to people and discuss things with people and just be around people in general. Berger, who is ignoring his calls, but he does reach out to her again because he wants to talk to her and he misses her. And he realizes that even some of the Vanger family he enjoys talking to and learning about. Some he doesn't, obviously, but a couple he does. It's just that when you get that alone time with your thoughts, oh boy, does it sting. Before he reaches out to people and he reaches the pinnacle of his being lonely, a cat adopts him. And he obliges. He lets the cat in at night and then lets the cat out in the morning. He talks to the cat a little bit, as people do. The cat will meow at you or will nuzzle up against you, and you'll respond by saying, "Oh, I get it," or asking the cat what it wants, even though you know it can't respond, and you actually wouldn't understand it even if it did. And if it did respond by talking to you, he might be pretty freaked out, understandably. Anyway, this all shows that even though he won't admit it, the loneliness is aching and he wants to reach out and interact with other people. I already mentioned he meets some of the Unger family. One of those he meets is Martin, Harriet's brother. He embraces modern sensibilities. That's also described as sterile. The latter is a judgment often levied that things aren't as good as they were, that the sterility of, like, McDonald's. I just recently saw an image of how the McDonald's quote-unquote play place has evolved over the years, and the way that it looks now is just two screens on a wall instead of a ball pit and all this other stuff. So that's usually where I hear the argument about sterility. For me, my disdain for nostalgia is starting to meet my understanding of enshittification. I just listened to a podcast the other day where they talked about enshittification again, and I don't generally feel nostalgic. I think that nostalgia is a trap, but also the fact that they're taking the few things away from us that we used to enjoy and making them worse is not a good thing either. Anyway, that's perhaps a discussion for another time. Martin, for his part, seeks the modern to move on from Harriet's disappearance. It obviously pains him, as it's his sister, and he wants to put it behind him because the past represents that pain that he felt when she was abducted or murdered. The sterility that we see, actually, in this case, really isn't a judgment. It's just more the fact that he understands that he cannot move on without Harriet, and everything crystallizes into this sort of fake and sterile environment. The next part of the book that I'm going to talk about and deal with is the Wanger legacy and Salander's past. The number of times that I said Jesus Christ while listening to this part is too damn high. Larson gives us Nazis, soiling the blood, ethnic cleansing, genocide, and eugenics Nazis. Fuck every single one of these guys forever. I know they're fiction, but the Nazis that we're currently dealing with aren't, and they believe many of the same things, even if they won't quote unquote admit it to the public, or they'll fight against it by saying, "You call everybody you don't agree with Nazis." I will admit that is one mistake that people made over the last couple of decades, is just going straight to the Nazi argument, because now that we have actual literal Nazis, they can argue against it and people may not believe it. We are all the boy who cried Nazi, as it were. We'll obviously get more into this at another point, but this entire section is horrifying and disgusting to me. Speaking of horrifying and disgusting, we get a little bit on Salander's past. We get drips of a history, but mostly under the banner of what she calls quote unquote all that evil, which both makes you wonder, and as we will soon learn, serve as foreshadowing. We'll get more on Salander's past too. This being a mystery novel, the history of this particular character is also a mystery, but it's really not if you think about it. We can at least make the connection that she was abused in some form or fashion. However, before we get into all of that. We have Palmgren as her advocate. He is truly respectful in his advocacy. He knows the system, and knowing the system, he feels almost too good to be true. But people like him do exist, and they are the ones that we should put in charge. Too bad they have no desire to be. As they always say, never give power to someone who wants it. There's also power corrupts. Absolute power corrupts, absolutely. But generally speaking, people who don't want to be in charge, they understand where they came from and they want to use that power to help others. That's where Palmgren rests in this whole mess, although he is no longer in the picture because he had a stroke. So Salander really has nobody on her side in her corner. Chapter 10 deals with the investigation and Blomkvist looking at the previous documents from the investigation and trying to piece together what he can. We get Morell. He serves as both a mirror and a compatriot of Vonger. He's gone through all of it with Vonger. However, he does give a reason and an example to explain his obsession, even though he's not directly, quote unquote, related to the situation. He's just the investigating officer. Just the investigating officer, I say. He says there's one case like this for every officer that haunts them. He tells the story of another young woman beaten, raped, and murdered. The person asphyxiated her in the embers of a fire pit. Like, what the fuck? That shit would haunt me too. He doesn't say that that's the case that's haunting him. The Harry case is the one that's haunting him, but he tells it in the context of another officer who was haunted and obsessed with that particular case, which I can see how, because the other officer discovered the woman's body, and that's just gotta be horrifying to see the evils that men are capable of perpetrating on each other and on women. It's just, I don't understand, y'all. Cecilia is one of the Vongers. She figures out the actual plan behind Blomkvist, but he plays coy about it. She rattles his cage pretty hard, and he nearly breaks. Then they end up sleeping together. Again, not knowing the norms of Sweden, I don't know if that's something that happens often, but it does seem awful quick. I don't know. They're both lonely. I can't remember if this was before or after Birger shows up. I think it's before Birger shows up, so he's lonely, she's lonely. They find each other, and they are intimate. We also meet Salander's new advocate, Bierman. That's one of the reasons that she discusses, they talk about Palmgren, is because Bierman is the polar opposite of Palmgren. From the get-go, it is just fuck this guy. He's one of those two prevalent perverts that I talked about earlier, the people who go into these businesses knowing that there will be vulnerable people that they can take advantage of and abuse. It's, you see it too often, and I wish that there was a way that we could be better about stopping these people and getting them out of the system, because how do these people stay in the system? Jesus, I'm just tired of sociopaths being in charge. I sent a image to my friends and family that said, I'm sorry that I've been so distant recently, but I'm dealing with a planet that has infinite beauty and nature, and while we could be enjoying it, I'm having to deal with watching like 50 fucking sociopaths destroying what little beauty we have left for an extra nickel on shareholder value. It's both infuriating and depressing, and I don't know how everybody is not rioting at this point. You hear me? If the government is out there listening with whatever the hell they listen with, I hope you heard that loud and clear, because also, fuck every single one of you. Okay, the last chapter we're going to deal with is chapter 11. This is where the assault takes place. I don't want to spend too much time here. Yes, as I've discussed numerous times, violence against women is the primary theme of the book. But the way he writes it in such a matter-of-fact way makes it just so raw and real that I can't help but get angry when thinking about it. Larson talks about the legality frankly, then shows Bierman simply getting away with the assault. This book was written 20, 25 years ago, and we are dealing very much with something like this now as we watch our president just brazenly do whatever the hell he wants and face no consequences for his actions from anybody. That is just proof that these patriarchal systems regularly fail women. I mean, the president is an adjudicated rapist. He had to pay over $80 million in a settlement to a woman that he raped and then later sued for libel. So, as I said, libel laws in America aren't quite as strong, and rapists can get fucked. Part of this shows that Salander is just another stat in the column of being failed by the system. She does think about reacting by stabbing him with a letter opener, but she knows from experience that it will come back to her. He's the one who raped her, but if she attacks him, she's going to be the one who faces the consequence. So instead, she performs without emotion and leaves the same way. This was all a trap set for Bierman, who thinks her weak. However, she is lying in wait to spring that trap on him eventually. Once again, fuck this guy, and we will all be cheering when he gets exactly what he deserves later in the book. So, the major theme that I already talked about is violence against women. This is the book's beating heart. It is ultimately the reason for the book. If you think back to the original title, Men Who Hate Women, when I looked back and did some research on the company that made mouthwashing, I saw that it is a Swedish company. I've read in the past that violence against women is not uniquely a Swedish problem, but it is a problem that they recognize and understand and try to point out as much as possible to bring it to the light. That makes Bierman's assault not simply a plot point, it's his core thesis, as I said, about how institutions fail women. Salander's silence and her not reacting, responding, retaliating is a survival instinct. It's not weakness. Like I said, she is setting a trap for Bierman that she will later spring on him. Leading into the next theme, the failure of institutions, which I talked partially about. Not only does the legal system fail Salander, but the psychiatric system fails her. She is seen because she won't talk to them. She's seen as slow. And they use that to take away her freedom and put her into receivership advocacy. I was just saying because we heard Britney Spears over the weekend, and my wife said something about it, and I said, yeah, she gets put in receivership for dancing around with knives and cutting her own hair, but men regularly abuse and kill women, and get away with it. Also, the social services clearly failed her because they allow somebody like Bierman to not only exist but thrive in the system. Larson is using Bierman as a stand-in for the state and their failure to protect people that they themselves said need protecting, mind you. This particular section talks a lot about isolation. I talked about that already. Cylinder is physically isolated on the island until he reaches out and talks to people. Cylinder is socially isolated. She has no family support. She doesn't really have friends. She has associates that she works with, like Plague and a couple of the others. Both are clearly alone. They're just alone in different ways. I've talked about this in the previous episodes, but appearance versus reality. Cecilia looks like a sharp, capable teacher, but she's Vonger's daughter, and Vonger says not to trust anyone. Martin looks modern and successful, but his house is sterile and impersonal, like we talked about. So with Cecilia, she puts forth this confident exterior that's hiding a less confident interior. Martin wants to move on, but he can't, so he has the modern look, but the sterile feeling behind it. Cylinder cultivates her look so that people will underestimate her, so she uses this to her advantage like Cecilia does, whereas Martin becomes a slave almost to his. And finally, we will get more into this later, the Vonger family and inherited guilt. As I said, there are literal Nazis in the Vonger family. Harriet's murder, they say, is part of a pattern. Larson, through this family, says that the sins of the father are paid by the son. Is that how the old saying goes? Something like that. But basically saying that you can't escape your family history or your family's sins. They will come back to haunt you unless you deal with them. What do they say these days? Breaking those generational curses? Yeah. That is something that people need to work on. And the Vonger family definitely has some stuff to work on. Bloomquist is stuck in his investigation on the island. He's not really getting anywhere. He's going through boxes of files. He sleeps with Cecilia, but none of that really gets him any closer. Cylinder has just been assaulted by Bierman. And walking out like nothing happened. We know Cylinder. She's a survivor. She will be back. And Bierman is going to get his. Also, there is going to be a development in the case in episode 4, which, if War Wizard doesn't come, I will release in the next week or so. I think that's it for this particular episode. So, as always, thanks for listening. You can find me, if you haven't already, at slucas.me. I have articles, mostly just articles about movies that I've seen this summer. It's been a good summer for movies again, so there's reviews up there. Can't remember what else. There's this podcast, obviously, a link to our socials, TikTok and YouTube, where I have videos I've been uploading more regularly. The latest one I did was my Game Boy Advance Hidden Gems. I'm going to do my deep dive this week, and then I can't remember what the next one is. I also brought the archives from Two Guys Gaming over to the page. I set up a page where I'm keeping track of my Ready Player One challenges. So the site is alive and breathing. If you just go check it out. I'll be back with the next episode of this series either this week or sometime next month if War Wizard ends up showing up in the meantime. I'm also going away on another vacation, so August might be slow. They do call it the dog days after all. But I'll figure it out and we'll work through what we need to work through. I also have November if I need to catch up on these two books, since I'm doing Dracula 4, Frightober. I will talk to you next time. Bye, guys. Be good. Stay safe. Have fun. HessLucas.me presents.
Series. I am reading and reacting to The Girl with the Dragon Tattoo, the novel by Stieg Larsson. This is part three of the series. In the last episode, I covered chapters 5, 6, and 7. That's where Lumpus leaves his job at Millennium. Berger's protests, but I think they both understand that he needs to prevent anything else from happening, and he'll give him time to try to clear his name, go to prison, whatever he's going to end up doing. He gets in trouble by slandering, libeling a media, a mogul named Fenestrom. We also get that Salander has a annoying feeling about Fenestrom, so that's one of the ways that the two of them are going to interact in the future. So far they have not, and there will be none of them actually interacting. For this episode, I'm going to talk about Lucas on the island and getting started on his job, which is on the surface to put together a history of Roger's family, but mostly it is for him to look into Harriet's disappearance and her possible, and to possibly figure out maybe where everybody else has missed something. Because Roger is obsessed with the case, and he just wants to get settled before he dies. Also, Salander, her past runs into her present. This So, I don't want to give away much more than that, but if you understand the book, then you know ultimately what that means. Okay. So, I mentioned that this. So he was with Lucas off the island and about the various members of the family, because Bonger thinks that one of the family members is behind Harriet's disappearance. That's why he thinks that Lucas will be able to get away with it by pretending to do a family history, because they can take on to everybody. I think I mentioned briefly last time that the setting of the island becomes a character in the book. And I'm going to talk a little bit about that now. When we're going through a tough time, we often think that we want to be left alone. Lundqvist gets that and realizes that it's not actually what he wants at all. He wants to be with people, talk with people. He ends up going to local cafes so that he can at least needs to be with people and be outside of his loneliness for a little bit. Beggar, who ignores his calls, and even the Thunder family, he ends up interacting with because he can't really take the isolation as much as he thought or hoped that he wanted, I guess. Because ultimately, when you get that alone time with your thoughts, oh boy, can it sting. Another less subtle, I don't know. None of it's really terribly subtle, but it's really the sting and wants to get out and talk to people. But a cat comes to his door before he actually reaches out to the people at his pinnacle of being lonely. It adopts him, and he watches towards the cat again to the house from the night to go on with Al at dawn or whenever the cat is going out in the morning. Already, even though he won't admit it, he starts exercise with loneliness aching and pushing him to go outside and meet people. So we, as I said, we meet some of the family this time around. One of them is Martin, Harry's brother. He embraces modern sensibilities. It's his life. His house is also described as sterile. The latter is a judgment. Often levied that things aren't as good as they used to be. Now, my staying with Thorin and all of now, for me, my disdain for nostalgia is my understanding of certification. Perhaps a discussion for another time. Modern. Martin, for his part, seeks the modern to move on from Harriet's death. Forget the past. Represents nothing but sorrow. And he wants to move on. The stability